It's September 5th, 2011, and this is the Hell Yeah Show. And hello and welcome to the Hell Yeah Show. I'm Alan.
I'm Emery.
And we are bringing you best practices for fail-free living. That's advice on how to not let technology ruin your day. Emery, what are we saying to people?
We're ready to believe you.
Exactly. That's our motto here at the Hell Yeah Show.
Yeah, well, some would argue that we borrowed it from the Ghostbusters, but it's still pretty solid. And I feel like a little bit of a fraud since I've had some very trying few days on some backup strategy and data organization type stuff.
Oh, boy. Do tell.
Yeah. Well, this summer has kind of been my my digital housekeeping summer. So I've spent a lot of time on
cleaning your desk.
Well, a little bit of that, but also things like, you know, where am I storing all my stuff? So like, where do all my files live, and where's all my email, and where are all my documents, and where are all my photos, and things like that, and trying to pull in a little bit from how it's been kind of spread out all over the place over the last few years. So there's been a certain amount of that going on, and I've been struggling to figure out what I'm going to do to back up my files. And I'm so far leaning towards Duplicity using Amazon S3. And Duplicity has it can encrypt and sign your backups with the GNU Privacy Guard. So I can use my PGP key and encrypt all my backups to myself or to like a general account, and then shove them all into Amazon's S3 storage. So nice. I'm kind of liking that.
I don't actually know Duplicity. Is that a Mac app?
Nope. It's a Unix CLI tool. It runs and it builds just fine on OS X if you use a Homebrew or Mac ports or probably even Fink. There will be a Duplicity port available. And Duplicity, it can do things like shovel all of your backups. I mean, it does incremental and it does full and it does deltas. So it's fairly fast at pushing change stuff somewhere else. I really like it a lot. It's pretty straightforward. Once you get the hang of the syntax, some of the command line options are a little crazy. So there's a good opportunity again for someone to come up with a nice GUI wrapper for that. But I like it a lot. And it'll also, you can shove it to even an IMAP store. So if you wanted to use like a Gmail account as your cloud backup, you could do that. It does S3. It does SCP and SFTP, even plain text FTP, which is ill-advised. But S3 is cheap, and I've been playing around with EC2 a little bit. So I've been motivated to take a crack at it. So,
all right.
I like it.
Very cool.
Yeah. I was using Spider Oak a lot, and I really like Spider Oak. My only complaint about it is that I was using the folder sync function of it quite a bit so that I could, you know, reliably have the same folder on multiple computers. And the problem I was having was that, like on my MacBook Air, if I hadn't used it for a few days, it would take a really long time for it to synchronize with everybody else, because it has to build like this metadata database. And it got a little pokey and a little frustrating. And I found that I was not running the software very often because of that. And then I was like, well, that's a really, really dumb idea.
on a sort of semi-related note, I think I saw, I forget if it was a Twitter message or a blog post or something. You were talking about MD import using 100% of your CPU.
Yeah. Yeah. I
run into that quite frequently.
Yeah. The other thing too is that I've been testing the Z for 10 software from 10's Compliment. So I've been using their beta ZFS stuff on Mac OS 10 and I love it. It's fantastic. And it's going to be amazing when it ships. It'll be phenomenal and you're going to want it, but I've been really liking it a lot. But the problem is since I use ZFS to arbitrarily carve up and mount file systems like willy-nilly, the Spotlight databases will automatically kick in periodically, so I end up like having a MD import sucking up all of one of my CPU cores. And it's a little
not only with external drives but with things that leave large cache files, I've found it can be absolutely terrible. Specifically, an MMO we both have played.
Yeah, you know the trick for that, though, right? If you've got a folder, you don't want it to import?
Yeah. I want my... We're talking about WoW. I want my add-on files to be backed up, but I don't want the cache files. So I just, you know, add the cache folder to the private section, the exclude section, basically.
See, you can do it that way. What I did, I took a slightly different approach. If you rename a folder in the Finder or in the terminal, whatever, and you just name it to whatever its currently name is, .noindex. So in my applications folder, I have a World of Warcraft .noindex, and then none of that stuff gets indexed by Spotlight, and it doesn't get, I don't know, it probably still gets yanked in by Time Machine. I don't think that changes that. But
right.
You know what I use for my add-ons, though, because I'm such a
I think I've heard.
Well, I use Git.
Oh, I thought you were using SVN.
I was using SVN.
Switch to Git. Yeah. Okay. Now that's probably a bit overkill, but probably not a bad idea either.
It's, you know,
probably saves some time.
It's very handy.
Yeah. Nice. Can I fork your add-on configuration?
No, you can't do that. But you can fork this conversation onto other Amazon news.
All right. So let's see. Some stuff in the news that we wanted to talk about. There are some new devices coming out that we've alluded to, or at least we've alluded to one of these. But I wanted to sort of run through these because these have been in the news. The Amazon tablet is almost certainly happening. We had talked about this, I think, 2 or 3 weeks ago. And and we had said we thought it might be a sort of multi-touch color iPad competitor. Maybe not. Maybe it's just a better e-ink. Maybe a color e-ink. Turns out it is at least what they're releasing in a reasonably soon timeline is going to be, by all accounts, or by at least one very reliable account, is a 7-inch color tablet with capacitive touch. Expected to retail at about $250. It runs a version of Android, but it's going to be almost entirely Amazon branded. So you've got an Amazon App Store on there, you've got an Amazon interface, you've got almost no traces of Google on the device.
So it sounds like they're going to be doing a really tight package, like what Apple has done with the iPad.
Right.
And using Android as their foundation, they're going to let people have a very similar experience, but with a very different marketplace and a different philosophy.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's going to integrate, of course, really well with all the Amazon services, which is what we talked about. It's basically you've got your there's actually a rumor that Amazon Prime will come free with purchase.
Oh, so that's leading us to believe that it'll also be set up for the streaming stuff too.
Yeah, I'm sure it will be, and I'm sure it'll integrate really well with all the Amazon services.
It's going to be really cool.
Yeah, and of course you're just talking about having all your backups in Amazon S3. You've got cloud services right there, so all of your data can easily be synced through all of the Amazon cloud services. It'll all work really well. Go ahead.
Well, that remains to be seen, right? Because, I mean, S3 is not really, it's not like a file system you can mount like a DAV file share or something like that. I mean, it's definitely designed as a place to shove binary objects into.
Right.
And kind of treat it like a locker. So I bet that there's, you know, there's definitely, again, there's probably people that are working on ways to put file systems on S3 in a way that's not so transaction-based, because right now a lot of the options are very, I don't want to say slow, but like in Transmit, Panix FTP client. They also support, among other things, S3, and you can even mount your S3 volume on your Mac.
Yep.
And that's kind of cool, but there is like some hefty latency there, right? Because it's checking a file back and forth, and it's using a different method than
it doesn't behave like a network drive.
No, yeah. It does not.
Yeah.
And that's because it's, you know, it's a web service, and that's, it's not a ding against it. It's, you know,
it's just the way it's built. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's, it should be interesting.
So, some other things though, apparently it's going to be initially Wi-Fi only. And then you can imagine something iPad like where there's a 3G pay a la carte type monthly fee, but I'm thinking there's almost certainly no free 3G on this thing like there was on the Kindle. Like there still is on the Kindle if you pay enough for it up front.
Well, why can't they have that be an option? Do you think they're just not making it with a 3G radio?
No, I think 3G will totally be an option. I don't think it will be free.
But I think, do you think that they're not going to let you pay like $400 instead of $250? And just have it,
and get free lifetime 3G like the Kindle.
I don't know about lifetime,
quote unquote lifetime.
Lifetime
subject to service agreement. Yeah,
yeah, sure. So I mean, you don't think they're going to do that?
I don't think so because I think there's going to be too much potential for massive data use on that thing that carriers are going to say no. that there's no amount of money that Amazon can pay the carrier up front or pay the carrier over time and have it be worth it for everyone to do that, given that this thing is a tablet, it's going to stream Netflix, it's going to do, maybe it won't, maybe it'll just stream Amazon.
Yeah.
But presumably people could use it to, it's based on Android, so people could use it to do other things.
I would imagine that there will be the equivalent of a jailbreak very quickly,
sure,
where people will have custom boot ROMs for this thing that are available for the quote unquote power user set.
Yeah. And you've got that sort of thing. I'd imagine you've got that sort of thing on the Kindle too. I don't know specifically, but I do know you can go in and change some things like the pause screen images or the lock screen images, that sort of thing. And I'm guessing you can probably go further, but that device is limited by the fact that that screen is not going to let you do very much web browsing. It's certainly not going to let you watch internet video. But this new device, especially if it's got Amazon Prime built in, there's a very real potential for this device to consume a lot of bandwidth. And I just don't see that bandwidth coming free with purchase of the device.
Well, they let you use the Netflix app on 3G, right?
Sure, yeah. But
and that's like supposed to be like a hideous protocol. Like, there was an article not too long ago. I'll see if I can dig it up. But someone was talking about Netflix, and they said that like the way that that service is designed and the way that they stream their content, it's just really inefficient.
Wow, huh? That's fine. But I think it'll be subject to, you know, you're going to have a 2 gigabyte a month plan or something, and you're going to be able to stream Netflix over 3G or do whatever you want to do, but it's going to have to fit within the constraints of that plan, and there's going to be no Kindle-like free unlimited 3G is what I'm predicting. No,
if they have this device coming out and it supports video through the Amazon Prime service, there's not a chance that they have like a metered cellular radio in it. That would absolutely kill it, because all it's going to take is like 1 month.
Yep.
The first few months is available. It's going to be like all over the Wall Street Journal and USA Today. There's going to be like, you know, someone left their streaming service on and they got like a $10,000.
And it's all
bill
through Amazon. So Amazon should be taking care of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So maybe that's why there's no free or there's no 3G version period coming out, as far as people are saying, because they can't negotiate these contracts.
That could be. And it could also be that, you know, they want to get an idea of what the actual utilization will be.
Right.
I mean, they don't know necessarily. I mean, they can predict within reason, but unless they've actually got, you know, a warehouse of these things spun up and streaming, they have no way of knowing what the real hit's going to be.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, the other part here is, that apparently they've got a multi-touch e-ink hybrid device of some sort.
Oh,
in development.
Oh.
But not ready anytime soon.
I wish I knew what anytime soon meant.
Yeah.
That would be really nice.
Yeah.
But, you know, like I said, like 2 weeks ago, I think when we were first talking about this, Apple has a hybrid also in the works. So I think there's a lot of people working on it.
Sure. Yeah. And I don't know what I'm sure if you look deep into it, and maybe we could find something about this, but I'm sure if you looked into the supply chain, there are people developing that kind of display. And it's just a matter of getting it cheap enough and getting it in mass enough quantities and getting it into a small enough form factor you can get it in a portable device like that.
Yeah, and Apple won't want to use it unless it can be glass, right?
Right, yeah, and getting over it, yes.
Yeah, they have to be, like, they have a very specific design strategy for their displays, and I don't know that that they'd be able to do a dual-layer display and have the glass touch on front.
Right, right.
That'd be... Well, I mean, I'm sure they can figure it out if anyone can.
Yeah. So, anyway, but that's apparently down the pipeline. But what's happening right now is going to be very soon, likely before the holidays, because that would make a lot of sense. You've got this 7-inch color tablet with capacitive touch, which I think will shake things up. I think it'll be a really interesting product.
Yeah, I think. I have a Reve iPad and I love it, and I didn't buy an iPad 2 mainly because I knew the timetable was leading there to be like an iPad 3 before I would really need the iPad 2 in terms of like the software I use and the things I like to do with it. This is going to be an interesting option.
Yeah, definitely.
This is the first tablet I've heard about other than an iPad that I could possibly give a rip about.
Right. Yep.
And it really is because of that branding and management and completeness of the package. Like the service itself means as much, that like the presentation is every bit as important as the capability.
Yeah,
that's something that not a lot of people get. I'm glad.
And you've got a lot of Kindle owners out there that you could sell this to as, here's the new Kindle.
That's true.
And
it's not expensive.
Right, right.
I mean, if you were buying a Kindle, you're not going to balk at this, I don't think.
No. And in fact, the original Kindles were about this price.
I think there are more.
If I remember, yeah, they may have been around $300.
Another $325 for the...
you might be right about that, for the 3G version.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was definitely up there. It was not as high as the iPad, but it was definitely up there. So if they can offer this thing at $250, that's pretty impressive, especially if it comes with a free Prime subscription.
Yeah, that, absolutely. And then, and also, I mean, I think you and I had a conversation about this, and I was talking to some other people, and you know, Amazon's core constituents, if you will, like most of the users and buyers that they cater to are people that are very, I mean, they're looking for a low price.
Yeah.
And, you know, Amazon, I don't think, has ever let them down in terms of their own branded products. I mean, the Kindles have held up pretty well, I think, and no one really has a whole lot of terrible things to say about them. So it's it'll be interesting. I mean, they know they got to keep the price as low as they can, and that's $250 is certainly low.
Yeah, yeah. So then on other upcoming device news here, we have another iPhone prototype being lost in a bar.
Yeah.
This happened again.
Apple engineers love to tie one on.
So this was lost in a bar in the Mission in San Francisco, where your bag was made.
Yeah.
And Apple tracked it, I'd assume via something like Find My iPhone. And and so they tracked it to a house in Bernal Heights in San Francisco. And they showed up with the police at this house.
Yeah.
Basically saying, we know the iPhone's here, and we need to look around.
Or that it was, right?
Or that it was at some point, yeah. And the owner said they had no knowledge whatsoever of the phone.
Sure. If I had a bunch of cops on my front lawn, I don't know what they're talking about either.
The police did a full search of the home. They didn't find anything. And so then the police leave or something, and apparently the Apple employees just straight up make an offer to the guy as like, no questions asked, just return it to us, here's a check.
Okay.
And the guy still said, I don't know what you're talking about.
I think it's too late. I think it's already out. I mean, we don't know the details of how or when and what the timetable was, but... And it's very likely that this dude, I mean, didn't the owner of the house works at the bar that it was lost at, right?
I think he was just another person that was in the bar. I'm not sure about that, though.
Well, he said that whoever they talked to or whoever owned this house, they said that they did know or that they were there the night that it went missing.
Sure. Yeah.
They said, yes, I was there. You know, to say that, you know, you never, like, it was clearly there. Somebody was in the residence with it, and whether or not it was this person or someone else from his party.
Yeah, that's certainly possible.
Yeah. If I go to a bar, I'm probably not by myself.
Yeah.
So, you know, and he's probably not going to tell you who he was with, and that's, you know, you could probably figure that out. But I think it's very likely that they have other information available that they could, you know, try to track it from there. But if someone knows that it's hot, they're going to try to get rid of it. But my initial, like when I was first reading the story, I thought, you know, maybe this guy has it, but he put it up on Craigslist and didn't know what it was, and someone's got it and it's long gone. But I think now that I think about it, it's more likely that like someone in his group was with them, and he might legitimately not even know that his friend stole a phone.
Yeah. Yeah. And so maybe they had Find My iPhone on up until they got to this house, and somehow they managed to either turn it off or turn off the cellular radio or something like that. Because, well, I'd imagine on test devices, Find My iPhone is probably, or whatever the equivalent is probably enabled and not disableable.
As far as I know, that's not true. It's my understanding that they're using the same, I mean, their internal builds and their test
because
builds.
Because they want to test it as it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I don't think they have like a special...
I'll buy that. Yeah. So then let's say this person goes, pure speculation here, but this person is in this guy's party, gets back to their house, realizes I probably better stop this thing from tracking itself, shuts it off there, and that's sort of the last trace they have of it, or something like that.
Yeah, that's my theory.
All right, and so the key quote, the key part of this story, my favorite part of this story, is they went and they interviewed the bartender at Cava 22, which is the tequila bar where the phone was lost. And this quote from the bartender, Jose Valle, I believe, quote is, "I guess I have to make my drinks a little less strong."
You're in a tequila bar. Good luck with that.
I just love that they first of all they track down the bartender and interview him, and then he's just like ambivalent about this entire situation.
Wait, what does he care?
It's like, I know it's great.
Cell phone, how is this big news?
Fantastic. All right. Yeah, so that's our rundown of new devices that haven't been announced yet, but that are almost certainly coming up on the horizon. It's hard to imagine that either of these devices won't be available by the holiday season. So
Yeah.
Okay, moving on. This next thing is something that I'm not particularly well-versed in, so I'm hoping you can fill in the blanks here, but you want to talk about internet networking paradigms.
I do?
Yes, you do.
Okay. Oh wait. Yeah, I think I do.
I was
the first one, because I'm looking at the show notes and it's you know, the comparison of the different types of DSL, and I'm like, well, so I mean, do you not know the difference between SDSL and ADSL?
I do, because I read up on it for this show, but I'm still relying on you to make this explanation happen.
Long story short, to translate from nerd into a regular person. SDSL is symmetric, and it means that it has the same amount of bandwidth available going both directions. So your upload speed is usually the same as your download speed, and they're usually a little bit lower than other options. ADSL is asymmetric, and you'll usually have like a much larger download speed with a very low upload speed. And without getting into like how they build these networks to do that, and et cetera, and what the differences are, in that respect, most consumers get ADSL because it's something that they can get faster downloads. SDSL is typically a small business service for people that otherwise would be buying like, you know, a T1 or Fios or something like that. Back in the day, I want to say mid to late 90s, your options, very few people had access to DSL, and the cable modem service at the time was usually one way. So you had a cable, quote unquote cable modem, that you had plugged into the wall, and then you had to dial up to send traffic back. do you know about this?
I don't remember that that ever being the case for me, at least. My only experience was going from dial-up to DSL, to just straight-up send and receive DSL a single jump.
I had ISDN, so I had the intermediary technology for a while, which was 128K, because I had the big ISDN. And because you could get it in either 56K or 64K, it depended if you were in the U.S. or in Europe or wherever. In the U.S., we had usually 64K or 128K ISDN, and then you had like probably like an Ascend Pipeline 50 ISDN terminal adapter in your house, and you were paying ass loads of money for very slow service that your cell phone can perform better than now.
Sure.
But yeah, it was a good connection in that it was reliable and steady. I had SDSL also. I've never had ADSL. Hmm. But I have a cable service now that I hate with a passion. And it's through a regional cable company called Mediacom. And they have like they're actually great up to a point. So I love the fact that I can get like 20 meg service from them. It's very fast a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it just completely flakes out, and there's also this issue where they use some sort of packet inspection to look for 404 pages. It's not just the DNS thing, so it's not like some internet providers, if you're using their name servers, if you try to look up a domain that doesn't exist, they'll redirect you to some sort of helper page.
Yep, that sucks.
Mediacom, what they do is even worse. They inspect your plain text HTTP browsing traffic, and if they see a 404... So it's not just a page that's not reachable, but if you actually request a valid page and get a 404 response from a server, they intercept and they turn you over to some stupid like link page search engine thing.
Wow.
So that with advertisements. Yeah.
Wow. That's, yeah. I mean, that's enough. Just that one thing is enough to kill the appeal of an ISP for me.
Yep. I'm shopping around. I've only got two options though. I can use ADSL from what used to be Quest and is now like CenturyLink or something. And then I can't get Fios here, and the next town over has fiber.
Yeah.
Like legit fiber, and it's really good. But that doesn't help me any. So yeah, I don't know what I'm gonna do. Mm. But I'm really just not in the mood to have to go against or go up against my cable company. They can kiss my butt.
So the reason I bring up internet networking or the reason why you had suggested a show topic is because there was this recent comment or there was a recent dispute over the distinction between cloud computing and peer-to-peer networking.
Well, I read an article. Yeah, I read this article about Skype and why Google didn't buy Skype or something like that. And it was actually a pretty interesting article because, and I wish I would have written down who it was or what have you, and I'll try to find it for the show notes. But the long and the short of it was, it's not really compatible with Google's vision of how they want to deliver service. And Google and Amazon and a few other people, like, their approach is this quote-unquote cloud concept where infrastructure should live in large redundant data centers. Users will be able to use ubiquitous connectivity to access their stuff no matter where they are, because it will be stored in these large well-maintained facilities. Mm-hmm. So when you know people that use Gmail, they like it because it's always fast and it has all of their email. And people like other cloud services for some very similar reasons. Now, Skype, on the other hand, is peer-to-peer. So it relies on connectivity between other devices, and it kind of builds this mesh. And so people can make arguments in both directions as to why one is superior or inferior to the other, but it is an interesting design point or a design difference between technology in that some are going to rely on big infrastructure somewhere else and others are going to be relying on devices near you for things like connectivity and storage. So it's interesting to point out mainly because there are so many things that get shuttled around in Congress right now, and things like this network neutrality debate. There are state governments that are trying to, like in the case of Wisconsin with the telecom stuff going on there, and some of that's a union dispute or whatever. And then the other part of it is they're trying to funnel some of the stuff that WISCnet, which is the Wisconsin like state network, and Iowa has one too, and they're trying to figure out if they can like privatize that by punting that off to someone like an AT&T or somebody else. And while I think that in the particular example of Wisconsin, the AT&T thing is a total sham and that it looks like this has been engineered for quite a while as a play by AT&T to take over that network to get more money for a service that is already working just fine and very inexpensively. I don't know. But there are not a lot of people writing law that really get the technology. And, you know, you talk about peer-to-peer, you talk about cloud computing. Some of these guys and gals have just figured out, you know, that they don't have to talk into the mouse. So what are you going to do with that? Who was it? There was someone on Bill Maher, one of the guests on Bill Maher was saying, and he's an astrophysicist, and I also can't remember his name. I got to take better notes when I'm watching shows. But he was like, you know, what's really weird about Congress is that, like, you know, the vast majority of people in Congress are lawyers. And from the time they were in high school, so from the time they were like 14 years old, they've been working to learn to make the best argument.
Right.
And you are judged and rewarded on how well you can argue against somebody else. So it's not, you know, the congressional structure right now is not built up to make good law. It's designed to out argue people that you don't agree with for other, whatever reason. So it's like this, Save Our Children Act or whatever that, Lamar's from Texas drafted this legislation to ostensibly to, check, logs with all ISPs so that you would have to retain IP address logs for your customers for like 3 months or whatever, so that they could come back and retroactively subpoena for data that you're that they shouldn't be logging anyways. And they keep telling people so they can find like child predators and child pornographers and stuff, but they seem to be doing just fine using actual detective work and police work rather than you know, passively monitoring everyone and assuming that you're a kid toucher. Why can't they just monitor actual criminals? Like, it's such a stupid thing. And it's like, you know, my suspicion here is that all of these maneuvers and this stuff that they're doing with this IP logging and Child Protection Act and all this nonsense, like, I think it's probably something that is funded and being lobbied for by the copyright industry so that they can branch out saying, oh, you know, thank goodness you caught these two pederasts in Wichita. So now I've got these five guys that are downloading copies of Transformers. We got to go after them.
Sure.
And I think that's coming. Like, I think that that's, you know, this is a, I mean, they've already got the information. So what they're going to do, and plus, I don't trust, I mean, my ISP, Mediacom, I don't trust them to wax my car without screwing something up. I certainly don't trust them to retain logs of like IP addresses that I've, I would not trust them to do anything. Like, I barely let them funnel packets for me.
Right, right. So the whole, you're talking about how the majority of Congress is lawyers and whatnot. The flip side of that is, say you're an engineer, what's the incentive to get involved in politics? You can make a very good living as an engineer, and and you're probably going to have you're going to be a lot more satisfied with your job. It's going to be a lot more rewarding, all that. Why would you go into politics? So that's a problem as well.
Maybe. Because, I mean, there, I don't know, like, you could probably come up with a good argument for, you know, helping people out. Like, right now, they have people that come in and testify at congressional hearings and stuff that are ostensibly engineers. And, I mean, there was a guy from Purdue University who talked to Congress after the Sony PSN break-ins, for example. Mm-hmm. Things like that. I mean, they do consult with people who know what they're talking about sometimes. But more often than not, they just write these knee-jerk laws that other people shove in front of them. And I guess, you know, maybe we need more engineers to be the people that are shoving stuff in front of Congress people. But I think that it's more likely that we're going to have to start seeing some differences in how we staff and how we get representation. The problem is that Congress is a, you know, a representative body. And unless you're in a district that there's probably a few places in the United States where you could get like a computer science guy elected.
I remember Lawrence Lessig briefly considered running in one of the San Francisco area districts.
And then
determined that probably wouldn't have worked and abandoned it. So Silicon Valley.
He wrote a shell script and he did some calculations and he had a spreadsheet that he made that told him that the possibility was low. But yeah, I don't know. Like, there's an awful lot of people out there who are opinionated enough and funded enough. See, that's just it. Politics is not something you get into. It's not really being a congressperson is not something that you're really called to so much anymore as something that you can get funded. And people in the tech industry are fortunately, as you said, you can make a pretty good living doing this. And you also have some people like the Lessigs and the Vint Cerfs and a couple other people that you and I know that you know, have that type of access and have those means and could fund their own campaign if they had to. But sure. You know, it's really a vote of confidence, right? It's like, and that's really what it is. I mean, I think in some cases, I mean, there was running for office. You do it because you think you can do it better than the person that's there. And I think a lot of people in the technology industry, not a lot of them are. They're not usually so ego driven. I guess. I mean, I guess in some circles they are, but not the kind of people that you would want.
Right. Not the people who are actually the engineers doing the hard work. Yeah.
You know, there's probably a bunch of people like at Google that are like, not, you know, Eric Schmidt level, but somewhere in the VP area. I'm sure there's some good candidates there who get law and they get the technology and they and they get, you know, what people are, how people are using the technology. That's the other thing too, is that the people in Congress, I don't think even understand what's going on. I mean, the obvious call out, of course, being what's his name from Alaska.
I always want to say Ted Kennedy, but it's not. It's it is another Ted.
Yeah, but you know, his the bridge to nowhere and all that, but. My staff sent me an internet on Friday, and I did not get my internet until Tuesday. Why? Why? Because the internet's not a dump truck. It's a series of tubes.
Ted Stevens.
There you go.
Yep.
And, you know, it's, and I think that that's, and that dude was like on the, on the committee, like the technology committee, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Like he was supposed to be an expert, but yeah.
Well, so I think the whole internet is a series of tubes thing. I think that's pretty good. I actually think, as from his level of understanding of the technology, that's a pretty good distinction, making the distinction between a big truck and a series of tubes, and yet everyone makes fun of him for it.
Well, that's because, you know, it doesn't take 2 days for an internet to get to you.
All right. So maybe he's made some other comments that didn't quite fall in line with that. But
Who knows?
Anyway, so in that case... when can we expect to hear the announcement of the Emory for State Senate campaign?
Never, probably not going to happen. But the I'm not going to rule it out. No, I don't know. Like I would be happy to. You know, sometimes I think that I would find it pretty rewarding though to work with lawmakers. And but I don't know who's whispering in their ear now. You know, like in the case of this Child Protection Act thing. Like I've got a few guesses, but. I don't know. I don't know if I want to be that close to it.
Hmm.
You know, so, that's a pretty shady business.
So we could probably count politics among your many phobias.
yeah, I'm a little allergic.
but we're making a point each show to discuss one of your phobias, and this show you've chosen insects instead of politics.
No, I hate insects, especially there are
or maybe in tandem with politics. Who knows?
Yeah. There's a so I will say that where I'm currently living, I have less problems. But one of the homes I had in Rhode Island was it was on the east side of town. It was an old Victorian house, and we had centipedes all the time.
Oh.
And they were huge,
yeah.
Like, monstrous centipedes, like straight out of Jurassic Park. And yeah. That was the worst part about it, was that they look scary. And they would run right at you. Like, these are fearless, fearless animals, and they look super badass.
Sure.
Like, and if they're big enough, when you, like, crunch – when you, like, stomp on a centipede and it's big enough, it crunches.
That's not appealing.
No, and if they're the other thing too is that if I think I can't remember how many times this happened, but sometimes if you like smack them, they like just disintegrate into nothingness.
I don't think that's physically possible.
Well, they don't really, you know, they don't disintegrate into nothingness, but like they just turn into dust, like they just go
right,
poof.
Right.
Because you know whatever they're made, like they're basically all exoskeleton, right? Like just one crunch and boom. But we also. We don't see too many of those here, but we have seen a couple of earwigs, and we do see centipedes.
Earwigs are not so bad. I can deal with earwigs.
Earwigs are slow moving, which helps. Centipedes, on the other hand, they're quick, and like I said, they scare the hell out of me. The best thing that I found to get rid of them, though, the place on the east side of Providence, the only remedy that I found for centipedes, like because there was a time where I would see like one or two a day.
Wow.
Like it was that bad. Like it was, and it just seriously freaked me out. Freaked my wife out. Cat hated them. But they would come in from outside, like just because it was an old Victorian and there was plenty of holes and places to get in. But
yep.
Diatomaceous earth, like the pet grade stuff, not the pool grade stuff for like swimming pool filters. But you can buy like a bag of this stuff online for like, you know, $2 for a pound of it, and it's like a bag of really fine flour, and what it is it's like ground up shells and things like that, and they give it to like dogs and cats that have like some parasitic infections and worms and stuff, because what happens is this stuff is like a powder, it's a very fine powder, but it slices the dickens out of centipedes or any other insect for that matter, because it's small enough that it just cuts them to pieces.
Yeah,
and they run out of fluids. So if you had sprinkled this like around your house or in your garden or in my case around the radiators and the windowsills,
yep.
I did see only a couple of centipedes after I was doing this, and both times I saw them, they did not look well. and I laughed. I just like you. I would laugh and I'd point and I'd be like, yep. "That's what you get."
Yep.
That's what you get.
That's what they deserve, the centipedes.
I know. But yeah, they definitely freak me out. And that's one thing that I do not like is smacking a bug with a shoe and picking it up and like, because you know when you can feel like under the paper towel?
Yeah, yeah. That means you need more paper towel.
That's so vile.
Yeah, my big thing is probably mosquito hawks is the thing out here.
Mosquito.
Or at least in California, mosquito hawks, they're like flying spiders.
Wait a
minute. Yeah. Have you not seen a mosquito hawk?
I don't know.
I think it's obviously a colloquial term for them. But
I've seen these.
But they are flying. Basically look like a spider.
It's a crane fly.
And fly like mosquitoes. The Wikipedia article is titled Mosquito Hawk, so I'm going to go with Mosquito Hawk. It can mean crane fly, dragonfly, damselfly.
But not dragonfly, because a dragonfly is a totally different animal.
Sure. Yep, you're right. It's crane fly. All right. I'm with you on that.
All right.
The crane flies are probably the bug that I have had to live with the most and have been the most disgusted by, because I've never dealt with centipedes. So
my BFF is afraid of crickets.
Really?
Hates crickets.
Crickets, especially, again, aren't so bad.
I don't know. We got big ones.
Really? Better than grasshoppers.
There was I have a friend of this that lives in Florida, and I'm sure they see some pretty sketchy bugs down there. But that was actually, there's some really huge... I had an ex-girlfriend who was down at South by Southwest one year in Austin, and like got into her rental car in the parking garage at the hotel.
Oh, this story cannot end well.
turns on the car, looks up, and there is a giant, like the size of your fist, cockroach hanging out outside on the windshield.
Like, it was outside though.
It wasn't in the car.
Okay,
but,
that's
you know,
fine.
You put your key in the ignition, you look up, and that's like right in front of you. I don't care if it's on the other side of the glass
and you
or
see
not.
The underside of it. Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
No. They're terrible.
However, it could be worse. It could have been in the car. So.
Yes. That's true.
Yeah. Anyway, all right. Well, that's your phobia of the week. We'll be back next week with another phobia. We may never run out of phobias. You may just acquire new phobias
as
the show goes on.
Podcasting, that's another good one. I'm afraid of podcasting.
Yeah, who isn't afraid of podcasting? All right, so we've got a Star Trek episode to discuss, but before we get to that, I want to run through a couple things here that we might just want to create a segment that is like Emery's recommendations or something, or Emery's points of the week.
Well, are you talking about the DigiNotar thing?
I'm talking about a couple things here, but we'll run through them quickly. Yeah, the first of which is DigiNotar. So go ahead and tell the listeners about this.
When you go to a secure website, you have the server that you're talking to has a SSL certificate. So if you see HTTPS, that means Hypertext Transport Protocol Secure, or SSL encrypted. The trust structure that you have in your web browser or on your computer... that distinguishes that certificate from a self-signed certificate or a certificate signed by someone that you don't trust is this whole concept of these certificate authorities. So there are these institutions and these groups and businesses that are responsible for signing and creating trusted certificates that they sign with their CA, their certificate authority certificates, so that when you go to a browser, it doesn't say, you know, this web server, www.citibank.com, is using an untrusted certificate, blah, 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 if you still keep talking to me. Who knows if I'm really who I say I am, et cetera, et cetera. The problem is that we've had a couple of certificate authorities get hit by attackers who then use their infrastructure to sign certificates that are bogus and that have been generated in error. DigiNotar has issued, apparently, signatures for star.com. So they could theoretically have the certificate on any website, and the website you go to would say that it was whoever they want it to be, among others. The researcher that you'll see in the show notes that we link to is a guy named Applebaum. He's actually someone that Alan and I know. I don't know if you know that. We don't really know
him
directly.
Definitely rings a bell. Yeah,
he's a IO error from Freenode IRC, and we know him through our friend Joy. So, at least the name. I mean, I don't hang out with him or anything. But,
I just saw him last weekend. I don't know about you.
Yeah, and he's got a pretty good write up on this. But long story short, I went directly into the macOS 10 keychain, found the Diginator certificate authority certificate, and I unchecked the trust button and said, deal with it.
Yep.
So as far as I'm concerned, they're dead to me. And anyone that uses a certificate from them, I don't give a rip. Like, they're off my list. And I did the same thing with Komodo.
All right. Should I do that?
No.
Okay. It's not, that's not something you'd recommend for the general public?
No, the problem with Komodo is a little bit different, because I was like a subordinate CA. I mean, I took it out, but I don't recommend that anyone does that just yet. If it happens again and their response is also terrible, sure. But the Diginator thing, I don't know what's going on, and I don't know that I keep up enough with what's going on with the Dutch certificate authorities out there. So it's in my best interest. And probably others as well, to at least consider untrusting it, at least until they get this all sorted out. Because until then, like, some of the people that they got certificates issued for were like CIA.gov,
right?
Law enforcement agencies, very well-known large companies, banks. Like, it's ridiculous that the browsers and the operating systems were so eager to take in these certificates from people that apparently just aren't really qualified to do it. I mean, compromises can happen at any time, but the CA system is one that is it's the race to the bottom in price, I think, that has really caused the most problems.
On what? On,
they automate, like, most certificate authorities now have so much of the process automated. It used to be that if you bought a certificate, you paid like over $1,000 for it, because you had this very lengthy background, like the trust actually meant something.
Yep.
And that trust relationship, I believe, has eroded in the last decade, because people are not doing the same amount of due diligence that they used to do in validating the identity of people. So, like, even VeriSign, I think, once back in the day got picked up issuing a bogus Microsoft cert. But that was very quickly caught. And it wasn't actually, I don't think, for Microsoft.com. It was because of, like, it had Microsoft with an S0FT or something. There was some other, I can't remember the details on it now, and someone probably will clue me in. But I don't think that anyone has so far had such a drastic screw up as Diginator.
All right,
well, and I yanked him, and you know, I think there's too many CAs in there. I should probably audit that list and see which ones I actually trust and which ones I don't.
I don't actually know. Can a certificate be signed by provided by multiple CAs? So if you uncheck one, you could still verify the certificate with another?
Oh, the certificate that they pass and present to you is the one that you're going to have to accept.
Okay. Yeah. So you're basically, there's now a section of websites which you cannot verify the identity of.
That's true. And you know what? And a lot of them, I don't care. Because even if the vast majority of all of their business, 99% of it, is like legitimate businesses and things like that, like, I'm going to guess that because they're a Dutch CA, they're probably European or Dutch companies.
Yeah.
So not too much of a hit. The problem that I have is that they've issued all of these bogus .com, .gov, .org, .net certificates that I will come into contact with.
Right. Yep.
And the person that's implementing those certificates is clearly doing so maliciously.
Yeah.
So right. your only protection against that is to stop trusting the CA. I mean, they issue these revocation lists, so they do send out and they cancel out the certificates, right? They can do that. But there are some situations where that doesn't happen, or that, you know, you can't validate for some reason because the CRL can't be pulled from a remote site, or, you know, any number of reasons. I'm trying to take a more measured look at who I trust and who I choose to let access my information. We'll have to talk about this next time, I guess. But we bought a new car, and at the dealership, this guy, like, the computer on his desk, I am certain is on like an open wireless, and that they're all using like Windows XP,
sure.
SP1, you know, yep. Like, he's like, sure. It's just so slow. I don't know what's wrong with it. And I'm thinking to myself, like, oh, are you kidding me with this? Like, Yeah.
Yep.
But, you know, Diginotaur, I took it out. I untrusted it.
All right.
I like people.
moving down Emery's list of things for this week, Control Plane.
I've never used it.
Oh, okay.
I put it in the in Evernote. I think it's probably where you saw it, because it looked cool, because the OS X Lion does not have like the location manager that Mac OS 9 had. You know, did you ever use
Yep. I used it off and on, but yeah, I remember in the Apple menu, you used to have the ability to change location.
Yeah, and they have that kind of in OS X, but it's like not nearly as good, and it's like, you know, automatic or whatever, and most people just put on automatic, but Control Plane looked kind of cool. The Jekyll thing, though, I've been playing around with that for the last week, off and on. I'm getting ready to move over to it full-time for Kvetch, at least, and Hey Emery. And yeah, I like it. It's been pretty slick.
And
it's been actually a really great learning experience for me. Because dealing with included style sheets and thumping through, you know, hundreds of markdown documents and sanity checking all that, and writing, actually using, you know, having to write some Ruby code to make my own little plugins to filter things is kind of cool.
Yep. And it's got to be refreshing to know that at a base level, you are aware of how your blog is functioning.
Yeah. Not only that, but that there's really nothing for someone to compromise.
Yep.
Like, you know, the server that I'm probably going to be rolling things over to is running Nginx for a HTTP server, which is pretty much like the dumbest, most stripped down, I know nothing, see nothing web server you can possibly have. So it's kind of nice.
Yeah, good.
Very and fast.
What is the backup project?
I'll talk about that another time.
All right, we'll have an update on the backup project in a later episode as Emery's Jekyll saga continues.
Yeah.
All right. Well, in the time remaining, I'm really looking forward to this. Emery assigned me.
You wanted a classic. Yeah, you wanted a classic. Or I wanted you to watch a original series classic Star Trek.
I will throughout this be making an argument of why we should continue on our path of watching Next Generation episodes instead of going back to the classics. Right. I did really enjoy this episode.
So this was actually, there's a few of my favorites, and a friend of mine sent me a text that same night and said, you know which one you should have him watch? Spock's Brain. Spock's Brain is a very distinct episode in the Star Trek series.
See, I've got no context for it because I have not seen a large sample of original series episodes. So as far as I'm aware, this exemplifies the series.
Well, it's a little slow moving for the series.
Okay, all right.
Spock's Brain is a pretty slow pace compared to others.
All right. Well, you should be watching along at home. You should, if you haven't seen this episode yet, pause it. Go to Netflix. It's on there right now. Season 3, Episode 1, Spock's Brain.
This is Alan's way of saying spoiler alert.
Yeah. But so do that now. We're going to talk about the episode. So let's see. Couple things. First of all, the arm remote sleep inducer.
You like that, huh?
Yeah. Well, I like that it had about 4 buttons on it.
Well, you've got sleep, and sleep.
Yes. Yeah. And I like that it would selectively make just the right people fall asleep at just the right times, depending on which button was pressed. It had a very
because of those belts.
No, but the sleep part of it was used even before the belts were on.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
So the sleep part had a very specific and efficient function to it. So you have this 4-button device, very efficient, and we'll get back to devices that have many less buttons than they should have for what they do. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I might, but I have to remind you that my home screen on my iPhone only has 7 icons.
Yes. No. What I'm actually talking about is the remote control for Spock himself.
Oh yes, that was delightful.
Which has a total of about 6 buttons, as far as I could count.
Well, forward, backward, left, and right. That's how Spock walks into that shrub outside the cave when they first walk up to it. McCoy like steers him into that plant. Yeah, it's pretty great.
Yeah, that's a great, great thing. And I
laugh.
Yes. Okay. Let me run through through what I've got here. So, let's see. I saw a lot of parallels to E.M. Forster's "The Machine Stops." Have you read that?
I'm going to say no, because I haven't.
It is online, I believe, because, yeah, it was published in 1909. So it's online. You can read it for free because it's out of copyright. And it is about a society that at one point built a machine, but the society itself is no longer able to understand or maintain that machine.
Oh.
And so the society itself dies because the machine dies and no one knows how to fix it. Which
that will happen to us.
Well, see, I don't think so.
Because that clock will be flashing 12 and we're all going to be too stupid to know that you can just change the time.
I feel like, the majority, if pretty much any technological advancement that we have made or that we currently have in real world, not in Star Trek world, that we currently have is understandable by one or more humans.
That's true.
Yeah. And as long as that's the case, I'm not particularly concerned.
Okay.
And that's the whole point behind The Machine Stops. And it was written in 1909, so it was really prescient for the time. And it commented on a lot of these things. And actually, I'm almost certain this episode was influenced pretty heavily by it. The idea of a society
that
no longer knows how to maintain itself and has to rely on Spock's brain.
Or a brain.
Or a brain, yes. But Spock's brain is a particularly good brain to use for that purpose, I think. It's
no
pretty,
kidding.
It's highly logical. Seems to be a very hard worker.
I think a Vulcan brain is probably your first choice, certainly above a Klingon brain.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Klingon brain running that facility would have been significantly more interesting.
A tribble brain, for example, would also be a very poor choice.
So I've got. Let's see.
You don't know what a tribble is, do you?
No, I don't. I don't. Yeah! That's why I'm skipping over that.
You're gonna watch that one next.
Okay. So we'll have to. I like that they decided to take Spock with them, and I like that the doctor's able to whip up this contraption to direct him.
Dr. McCoy's no joke.
He's
a legit
pretty
scientist.
Serious. He learned brain surgery in a matter of minutes.
Yeah,
yeah. Not just brain surgery, brain replacement surgery.
That's yes.
Yeah, that's pretty hardcore. Okay. This is a comment just in general about the original series. How do they work with so many whistles and sirens going off constantly on the bridge? I mean, it's incessant. It's terrible.
Well, especially when they're like on red alert.
Oh, but even without that, like even just normal, there are at least five distinct sounds happening constantly.
Well, I think part of it too is because where Spock and Uhura are sitting, like, if you did not have like some noises going off, you would think that they're just like doing nothing
right.
all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I mean, like when Spock is like doing his deep space probing thing, where he's like looking through that visor.
Yeah,
like you don't know what without a noise, it would be very boring.
Okay.
That's just my hunch.
I crack up every time they say Spock's brain, and they say it a lot. Those words are said many times by many people in an incredible variety of inflections. It's fantastic. If you were to just take all of the clips from that episode where people said Spock's brain and stitch them together, it would be fantastic.
Make a montage.
Yeah, a montage.
Spock's brain.
I like that they make it very clear that Spock's life is in danger. Kirk goes, and I quote, "If I guessed wrong, Spock is dead. Spock will die." That is his quote.
Yeah. I wanted to make sure you understood.
Yeah, yeah. I was disappointed that the red shirt, Mr. Scott, who was filling in for Mr. Spock, I was very disappointed that he did not die. Kirk turns and goes, "Mr. Spock, oh, sorry, Mr. Scott." And I'm like, that guy's dead.
No, he can't be dead.
Chekhov is my favorite.
Chekhov's pretty solid.
Chekhov single-handedly made this episode for me.
He's really good on just about all of them. My wife has a thing for Spock, though.
Ah, okay. All right.
Yeah.
Okay, and now Spock's remote control has all of 6 buttons. Quite efficient. Mm-hmm. I like that one of those buttons is the grab the person's arm and press the red button on their arm remote.
Yes. Yeah, you have to activate it.
It was very clever that they built that functionality into Spock's remote control.
That they thought to implement a use someone else's 4-button remote on the 6-button remote is very impressive.
Well, maybe at this point they've just standardized everything to the point where there are 4-button remotes and there are 6-button remotes, and that's all you have.
That could be.
Yeah. So
we
maybe
also don't
that
know
was...
if there's like a gamepad. There might be a D-pad.
Yeah.
Like you keep, you know, you're acting like it's just a flat thing, but we don't know if there could be like an NES controller,
some combination
underneath
with like of
a
button presses.
Start.
Yeah.
Yeah, like the Konami code, for example, yep. might have Spock might make tea.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
It could be like a pattern of buttons.
that Kirk knows going into this, because Kirk is the one, because the what is it? McCoy is the doctor.
I know the Konami code. I can remember that. I probably still remember the code to Mike Tyson's punch out.
Up, up, down, down, left, right, B, A, start?
No. Up, up, down, down, left, right, B, A, B, A, select, start.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And the code on Metroid to unlock the green hair is Justin Bailey. And the code on, gosh, what was it? On Mike Tyson's punch out, it's 003. No.
Regardless.
Sorry.
I do appreciate your arcane video game knowledge. Mike Tyson's punch out, solid.
Were it not for codes, I never would have seen the end of that game.
So anyway, let's see. I couldn't tell, but like there's a significant amount of what could easily be interpreted as sexism here, but which might be justified within the frame of the plot and the way everything's set up.
Yeah.
But they're constantly like they're saying hers is the mind of a child. And there's no sign of engineering genius in any of those women.
Well, you know, that's because that's all they encounter down there.
Right.
And then the dudes up above are also equally simple.
But then even when she puts on the cap and becomes the embodiment of all of their ancestral knowledge, they're still able to trick her fairly simply into giving up the phaser.
That's true.
And not only that, but then she acts completely helpless as they're like holding her wrist to detain her. So
maybe it was like a nerve wrist pinch thing. Yeah, I do tend to, and this is partially my wife's doing, but I am very sensitive to weird things like gender normativity or stereotypes and portrayals of. Not just gender and sexuality, but like a lot of other things in television and film. But that one does. My first brush with it, watching it again, was certainly along those lines. But it did kind of lessen a little bit, mainly as I met more of the people that lived underneath and how equally dumb they all were.
Right. Yeah.
Like I didn't think that. I guess what it came down to is that I didn't think that the intent of the writer was to outright mock
I'll agree with that.
And there is always going to be, as we've seen in other episodes, even on Next Generation, like there, science fiction especially is one of those genres where people sometimes play into stereotypes a little bit more readily, but I don't know.
So the other thing here is that Kirk is terrible at communicating with other cultures.
He's not great.
I mean, absolutely atrocious. Like, he's yelling at these people, "We need Spock's brain." And clearly, they've stated several times they have no clue what a brain is, and they have no clue who Spock is.
He's no Picard. Like, Picard has that episode where he goes to a planet and like learns another language to communicate with this guy, someone Tanagra. When the walls fell.
Oh, Darmok Angelad at Tanagra.
Yeah. Well, see, yeah, that. I mean, that's a fantastic Picard episode,
right?
And a little tedious, but certainly he's a far greater communicator than Kirk. Kirk is a badass. He's got a big belt buckle, and he strolls into a room and he shoots first. You know,
right? Yeah, that is one of the reasons that I'm saying we should go back to Next Generation. The other reason is the ending. I hated the ending.
Yeah.
Because the ending is, so Spock has recovered, has magically, the doctor has stitched him back up, and he gradually comes back online, which is great.
Sure.
So he's recovered, and his first in or one of the first things he does is sort of he tells everyone what he's learned, and he starts to tell them about the history of the culture and why they're in this current state and why that's so interesting and all this stuff. And then McCoy cuts him off and says, "I should never have done it. I should never have reconnected his mouth." Which, while a funny line and a great put down to Spock, is really not what I'm looking for. Like, I was actually interested in hearing what Spock had to say, and you know, that, like, they should have talked about that. That should have been the point of the episode. You know, it shouldn't have ended on this, like, mock comedic note that was supposed to be really clever and funny.
That's the way that show is done, and there is always this longstanding, you know, back and forth between, especially between Spock and McCoy.
Okay.
And, you know, much like our show right now, they were at the end of the episode, and they didn't have a lot of time, and, you know, they had to wrap it up.
Yep.
The music started, they had to play him off stage.
I am aware we're going over time. We're going as much over time as we went over last episode, but we're going to try and keep this to an hour if possible in the future. We do promise. Anyway, I think next week we should go back to Next Generation. I don't know if you agree with that notion.
I think we should do. I like occasionally watching Star Wars, or Star Trek. But I, I love Star Wars. But I do think that we should maybe spread it out a little bit. I'm afraid of losing people, and I don't want this to be a Star Trek show.
All right, that makes sense. Every other episode, something like that. Every fifth episode.
How about once a month? Well, the first episode, maybe the first episode of every month could be a Star Trek.
All right.
I don't know. We'll talk about it.
I can go for that.
And maybe we'll hear from somebody else. Our friend Kimberly from the internet. She'll probably say that she'll stop listening if we don't talk about Star Trek.
And if she's our only listener, then we really should be catering to her. So
we have dozens of listeners.
Dozens. All right. Very good. Let's see. That about wraps it up for this episode of the Hell Yeah Show. If you want to send us an email, show@hellyeah.com. If you want to learn more about the show or view past episodes, place to go is show.hellyeah.com.
HellyEah.com.
Yes. All right. We will be back next Monday, and I will have a proper internet connection then. It'll be very exciting.
I can't wait.
Yeah, it'll be good. That'll do it for episode 6 of the Hell Yeah Show. See you next week.
Farewell.